Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 95-year-old Calvin Pacetta of Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from Philadelphia. He joined the Navy 2 months before the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941 and stayed in for 30 years. We're going to hear about some of his adventures on an oil tanker, an LST, a submarine tender, and during the Korean War, a couple of destroyers. But his first ship was the battleship USS New Mexico. So tell us what your duties were on that ship.
I was a gunner's mate striker, naturally working on guns and everything, working on the old time 5-inch 51s, which was a powder bag. Had a shell which weighed about 50 pounds, 52 pounds, something like that. And you had to ram the shell back like you're back in the loading a cannon, back in the old days. Well, we were still loading them like that, which my job on there was to put this funnel thing on there, and it was a protection against, so he wouldn't hurt the breech block. So it wouldn't damage the breech block when they threw that shell in there. And then another guy went in there with I'm using my hands here to just demonstrate to you. But anyway, they would ram that shell all the way home, and then came the powder bag. And then we closed the breech block and fired it. That's the way they fired it in the days. Everything was manual. And like I say, my job was putting this funnel on it. And this gun captain told me, he says, son, he says, this is the most important job on this gun. Says, you make sure that you do it exactly like I tell you. He said, your first thing you do, after we fire, well, first thing you do is fire it first. But before you fire, look down that barrel, make sure there's nothing in there, no residue or anything, because we're using powder bags. So when you fired that gun, it left residue. It would shoot air in there. And if there's any residue in there, we had to get it out. So they sponged it. They sponged it out, because that was my big job that I had. But to me, it was very important, you know, that I did it exactly like he told me to do it. You know, put that funnel in there. Look down that bore, make sure there's no residue in there. Otherwise, they'd have to swab it out. Them guns were just antiques. I don't know if I got off of that ship after 15 months, so I doubt if they ever changed it. My secondary job was any aircraft gobs, and that was one deck above. And if a Japanese aircraft came in, we would had to abandon our 5-inch gun or the surface gun and run up on the next deck with the anti-aircraft gun. That was a little easier. It was a fixed ammunition, fixed shell with a fixed powder and a shell together, so it wasn't so bad.
Well, and I'm going to want to hear about any times that you actually had to do that, but I'm thinking about all the veterans I've had the privilege of meeting over the years. I've interviewed over 1,000 guys like you, but I can count on one hand the number of veterans I've met who had a father who also served in World War II. When did you find out that your father was actually being called back to active duty?
Well, I guess while I was on the New Mexico, I got, you know, a letter stating Pop was also drafted back in the Navy. He was assigned into the Navy Yard in Philadelphia, so that wasn't so bad. But also my brother, he tried to get in the Navy, and they wouldn't take him. He was colorblind, so he had to join the Army. But during World War II, while he was on Palau, the Navy recruited him to spot camouflage, because he was colorblind and he could see the camouflage that the Japanese had their guns carried, and when they'd fly over the islands, he could spot that. That was part of his. It was ironic, you know, that he did such of a thing. And he got, he got a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star, and he got shot in the butt. He didn't ever want to tell anybody about it. We found out.
What was his name?
His name was Jimmy James, same as my father's. And, of course, he was older than me. He wanted to go to the Navy first, but he didn't make it.
So, and if I'm understanding correctly, you're saying the Navy turned him down because he was colorblind and then recruited him because he was colorblind.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That is pretty supreme irony. So you're on the battleship New Mexico. What was your first experience? You'd seen Pearl Harbor and the devastation, but what was your first experience in combat, in an actual battle?
Well, I was on a tanker after the New Mexico oil tanker. Actually, I was supposed to go on to USS Princeton, and for somehow or other, some of the orders got mixed up. Princeton had boiler problems, so instead of going on to Princeton, they sent me on an oil tanker, USS Cossetot. We went through the African campaign, European African campaign, into Casablanca, and that was the first time I actually seen German. They call them Junker 88s. They made a god-awful sound coming down, dropping bombs and stuff. That's the first time I really, really seen action like that, anything like that. And that was kind of devastating. And then one of our ships in the convoy, we had about 65 to 80 ships in this convoy. And one night, the tanker, a few yards away from us, exploded, torpedoed. Oh, man. And you know, the survivors, they were telling us, well, we couldn't stop to pick the survivors up. That was up to our destroyers to do all that stuff. So we just kept on going in the convoy. It was so devastating there to see all these guys in the water and everything.
Where were you when that explosion took place?
I was on a ship. We were just getting ready to fuel ships at sea, these destroyers. Just stopped everything. Now, the refueling, we didn't refuel the destroyer until the next morning after that. After that, we got into Casablanca and offloaded most of our oil, and then made another trip back to Norfolk, Virginia. Anyway, we made three more trips, one to Iran, one to Missouri. But anyway, we made three more trips after that. And the whole time I was on there was 11 months. And I don't think I was dry one day out of that 11 months, because we had to fuel all these destroyers every day. The water line from the main deck was only about 5 feet. So we were always wet and full of oil, because oil is always spilling. You know, we always, and this was black oil. Was it sometimes a diesel oil if it was a destroyer escort? But most of the times it was black oil, and it was stuck like a heck. I had to get off of that ship. So after 11 months, I said, I had enough. I put in for another transfer to new construction. And they put me on the LST 589. And we had a train, because it was an amphibious ship, because sometimes we had to prepare to go ashore, because we went right up on the beach with the ship. You're familiar with LSTs? The bow doors open up and all the troops come. You're familiar with LSTs? The bow doors open up and all the troops come. We held, I think, 300 and some troops fully equipped. We put that in commission, and everybody aboard there was kind of green, because they never had these kind of ships before. These were a little different ships than the destroyers or battle wagons or cruisers. These were kind of flat-bottom ships. They only drew about five foot of water because they had to go up on the beach. We trained there for I think a month or so. I don't think it was more than a month. We trained amphibious training at Camp Bradford, Virginia. And then they sent us to the Navy Pier in Chicago. We were supposed to pick up the LST 589, which was being built at the time we were training. And I think they built that thing within 30 days. They took us by train to Evansville, Indiana. And we went aboard there. We had no idea, except from pictures that we seen, what we were going to find. So we actually had to train ourselves to use this ship. To steer it, it had a wheel too, but it also had a joystick like on an airplane. It was kind of odd, and it was kind of hard to maneuver that thing.
And what was your job on that ship?
I was a gunner's mate, and I had made E-4 at that time as a gutter's mate third class, actually. And I was on 40 millimeters. Nobody else in the whole crew except a few handful that knew anything about the 40s, 40 millimeters and 20 millimeters that they had on there. That's all we had was 40 millimeters and 20 millimeters. And it's just a handful of us guys that knew anything about the 40s. I was one of them. We had to trade all the other men on there that came aboard. It was quite a chore.
And you know, this is an aspect of World War II that I'm always amazed by. Obviously, there's going to be improvisation and combat, but I'm often struck by how much of what you all were doing, whether it was on land, at sea, in the air, what have you, had never really been done before, or you hadn't really prepared for it before. But here you are, brand new ship, brand new kind of ship. You're having to train people on the guns, make landings in the Philippines. I know you're part of the landings at Lingayen Gulf, in Zamboanga, and Mindanao, several other spots in the Philippines in early 1945. When the war ended, you witnessed a surrender ceremony that we don't hear about too often. A couple weeks before the famous Japanese surrender aboard the USS Missouri, there you were on the island of Aishima near Okinawa. And we have some photos and information about this at hometownheroesradio.com. General MacArthur had specifically ordered that the Americans the Japanese representatives would see first would be at least 6 feet 6 inches tall. He wanted them to be intimidated. And after that enemy delegation landed, they were taken in an American C-54 from Aishima to the Philippines, where the full-scale surrender was hammered out. But I want to talk to you about something that accelerated that surrender, President Truman's decision to deploy a weapon so secret that he didn't even know about it till President Roosevelt died in April, the atomic bomb dropped first at Hiroshima, then Nagasaki in August 1945, and you got to witness firsthand what kind of destruction that kind of weaponry was capable of?
We pulled in Nagasaki, they just let us go on liberty, but they told us to stay away from the actual rooms, you know. If you're going to take pictures, don't go too close because they didn't know how much radiation was still in the dirt and everything. They was telling us that nothing would be able to grow there for 70 years. But I guess that did turn out true. And we took pictures of course. And after that, they started checking. They checked me quite a few times for radiation, you know, in case you know, I got any radiation from there. So far, I'm still alive. I'm 95, going on 96. I'm still here, so I guess I didn't get no radiation.
Well, and a couple years after that, you were checking for radiation in a place a long way from Nagasaki, and it wasn't humans you were checking for radiation in, right?
Oh, you're getting back to the fish story.
Yeah. Well, is it really a fish story or is it true?
Oh, it's true. When they dropped when they were tested the atomic bomb on Anawitaw, I think it was Anawitaw, Bikini, and they had all these volunteers going to the Pacific, and the ship I was on was a submarine tender. And instead of going there, we went north. We went completely far north as you could possibly get. They had us fishing, actually, so it was kind of like a fishing trip. At the time, we didn't know what was going on. We didn't know about the atomic bomb, the testing. We did know about it, but we're headed in a different direction. We pull up the fish, and they signed us aboard. They would check the fish. If they were okay, no radiation in it, we ate them. The shrimps were so big, really. And then we'd stick the shrimp in a little steamer, like, and steam them and they'd eat them. I'd never ate so many shrimps in all my life.
And this was up in the Arctic Circle?
Way up in the Arctic Circle, yes. Well, as far north as you could go. And I think we was coming back late September. We stopped at different places, but on our way back, it was starting to freeze up, and we was getting frozen there, our ship. So they had to bring an icebreaker in to break us loose so we could get out of there. And we stopped at Adak and all the different places in Alaska.
Yeah, you've seen quite a bit of this globe that we're all on. And, you know, you would serve in the Korean War as well. By the time you retired, we're a few years into the Vietnam War. But there's another chapter of World War II that I want to ask you about. Something that's got a lot of attention recently is the story of the USS Indianapolis. They found the wreckage a little more than a year ago. There's a best-selling book out about it. There's been a documentary. And you actually have a connection to the start of the Indianapolis and the Japanese submarine who ended the Indianapolis. Help me make sense of all of that.
Okay, well, my dad, I think around 1936, again, I don't recall exactly what year, but he put the Indianapolis in commission and didn't think anything more about it at that time. But then when after the war, I went aboard this submarine tender. And, of course, being a submarine tender, we was attending all these Japanese submarines. So I believe there was something like maybe 26 of them. So on April Fool's Day, 1946, we took all these Japanese submarines out and we deep sixed them, what I call deep six. We opened the petcocks and set charges on all these submarines.
And we need to catch another break, but wait until you hear about the conversation Calvin Pasetta had with one of the Japanese submariners who had sunk the USS Indianapolis. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.